You're listening to Subsound Radio. We bring you streaming and live broadcasting from the capital. This is the El Arpa Podcast. Welcome to episode, I've lost count, of the El Arpa Podcast. Joining me in studio is Maria. How are you doing?
Hello. I'm good.
Okay, good. Nice intro there. So here we are again for our weekly update of all things English, all things interesting. So a few things to take care of before we get into the meat and potatoes of the main part of the podcast. So a lot of things happening in Spain at the moment. Mr. Pedro Sanchez has got himself into a spot of bother. What's happening there?
Well, I think since we had the last podcast that you said it was very likely that we were going to have a president, and now we have a president.
Okay, who is?
Rajoy.
Exactly. Everybody's very happy about that.
Very. And yes, and Pedro Sánchez, well, he resigned, and then now he's sort of like trying to be back with a vengeance.
Okay. Even the dog over there is not a Pepe supporter, so registering his dissent there.
Yeah.
But also, specifically with Sanchez, he kind of claimed that the media were putting pressure on him, or putting pressure on the election, but this is probably a whole heap of bobbins. Is this not true?
Yeah, well, he's kind of like, he appears to be changing his whole discourse. So.
Okay. Very good. Well, it's a
fantastic
way to open a podcast by political talk. So moving on to the next part of, not the next part of the show, but the next part of our introduction. Well, different things. Halloween is over now, so we're in the home stretch towards Thanksgiving and Christmas. The trailer for Trainspotting 2 has been released today as well, so if you're a fan
has
of...
Has it now?
It has. Danny Boyle's original. They've reunited four members of the cast.
Are you all still stoned?
No, but they are involved in Vice and other illegal activities. but visually, I think it looks as interesting as the original movie. So I don't know, I for one will be keeping an eye on that. We went to the cinema last week to see I, Daniel Blake, a new movie by Ken Loach, and that's what we're going to be talking about in this podcast. So we'll save the rancor and the disputes for the second part of the show. What else do we have to say to you? Well, of course... well, this is a podcast. We've been, you know, we're big fans of podcasts. If you're in the podcast game, you generally listen to other podcasts as well. There's a great article in The Guardian today, an interview with the inventor of the podcast, this chap who invented it 13 or 14 years ago in Harvard. I'd recommend reading it, you know. He's very passionate about the power of the podcast. He thinks that's... you know, it can and should change the world. We've been doing a podcast now for probably a year, I think. You haven't read the interview yet, but do you think the podcast is this amazing tool that gives people a voice that maybe mightn't have a voice, or can change the world and do all these amazing things?
Well, I think it's just a channel, you know, to express your opinion and communicate to others.
Well, it's still in its infancy. I think right now maybe you could argue it is the most honest of the media channels. I think there's a lot of kind of distortion as he tells as well in the interview, the podcast movement kind of came out of the Second Iraq War, when the America invaded Iraq for the second time, and how people were tired of a lack of debate about the rights and wrongs of it, and how it was so obvious that the media were towing the party line when it came to justifying a war that eventually, as people would soon learn, you know, was based on fabrications, no weapons of mass destruction, for example, and other kind of mistruths. So in that sense, a podcast is an amazing little thing, and also gives these two fools in Madrid who have a school called Arapa a soapbox in which to disseminate their crazy and barmy ideas on a weekly or not so weekly basis.
Yeah.
So
most importantly,
okay. So those are the little things that we are telling you in this first part, where we're going to have this music right now, and we're going to come back and talk about Ken Loach's fantastic, depending on your point of view, movie called I, Daniel Blake, which is in cinemas at the moment, and tells the story of a man fighting the system and looking for benefits from the state. So I'm sitting here with the woman who refused to share her popcorn in the cinema. So we're going to start. Well, how would you want to do this? Because we have very different views on this movie.
Yeah, I think I'm definitely interviewing you.
Okay.
For a change.
Very good. Okay, well, take it away.
Okay.
My weekends are tired from holding the microphone. So.
Okay, well, first of all, tell us a little bit about, you know, what the movie is about.
Okay, well, I'll give some background. Well, Ken Loach is a socialist English filmmaker. He's famous for making movies since the 60s. One of his first movies was, I think, called Alice Come Home. I can't remember the title. I'm very bad for that kind of stuff. But it caused a sensation because, you know, it was a movie depicting homelessness, and it led to a greater awareness of it in society. And this profile of Ken Loach in this moment has remained consistent throughout his career. If you're not a fan of his work, or if you're not a socialist, if you're a conservative, this is very much a stick with which to beat him. If you are of a similar thinking to him, as I am, I think it's very admirable. And he's made movies consistently along this vein throughout his career. He made an Irish movie called When the Shakes the Barley, which took a socialist view of the Irish War of Independence, which I think, and the subsequent Civil War as well, you know, very popular, won his first Palme d'Or, which was the Cannes Film Festival prize. He won his second one with I, Daniel Blake, which we'll talk about in just a moment. And he effectively came out of retirement to make this film because he was angry that people weren't angry about the state of Britain at the moment. He was angry that people weren't angry about the existence of food banks, and like all of his movies, he's a movie called Sweet 16, which is along similar, or The Angel of Dust, which is along similar territory as well. And you know, so he made this movie to make a political point, and all his movies are basically political. And you know, some people will object to that, but I think it's a good thing. You know, if you disagree with the political sentiment, then you probably won't like the movie, or his movies in general, his canon. But you know, since, as I said at the start of the second part of the show, I am kind of more in line with his thinking, so I am more open to what he has to say. For example, this week, Jeremy Corbyn and other Labour ministers are going to be attending special screenings in the movie, and Jeremy Corbyn has said Theresa May, the current British Prime Minister, should be watching his movie to learn more about the plight of people who are on benefits or looking to be on benefits. And that's basically what the story is about. It's about a man called Daniel Blake. He is a man who has a heart attack at work. He's declared fit for work, despite not really being fit for work. And that's how the absurdity of the system is portrayed at the start, and it's the starting point of the movie, and how the bureaucracy and how difficult it is to kind of get what you deserve is the kind of plot of the movie, and eventually how it can be a very dehumanizing process and how you can lose your self-respect in the process. And that's the message he's trying to convey with this movie. So as I said, he won the Cannes Palme d'Or for this as well. It's been generally very well received, and that's basically the background to the movie.
Okay, very interesting. Well, so now we sort of like have an idea about it. I think, well, probably one of the main criticisms that can be made to the movie, that has been made to the movie, is to what extent it, you know, exaggerates or dramatizes a situation, or whether it depicts it accurately. I think here it's probably important to make a distinction between, you know, as you were saying, people that don't share their ideas and therefore are never gonna see it from that point of view, and are always gonna be blind to the fact that those things are happening in their society, and then, well, maybe like objections about the exact way of portraying that, which we might talk about a bit later. But well, what do you think?
Well, I think it. Well, first of all, it's a movie. Mm-hmm. And even if it was a documentary, the same process would be applied to it. It's a camera, it's a man, it goes into an editing suite, you know. Everything is stylized to an extent. So even Louis Theroux, for example, who I regard as a great documentarian as well, you know, mm-hmm. his, you know, or even David Attenborough, you know, mm-hmm. you know, his documentaries about animals are stylized, or they're they're put through a treatment, you know. So I think
it's fair to say the movie looks very natural. It's very
because he uses amateur actors in most of his productions. Obviously, going back to When He Shakes the Barley, he used Cillian Murphy, who was a bona fide Irish star. But for the most part, he uses amateur actors. Sometimes it doesn't work so well, but again, it's a noble sentiment, because you know, if you have a movie about people with some kind of physical disability, people are keen to see physical, you know, people who have a physical disability in the roles of those characters. So I think if your whole thing is to make movies about the social, you know, the working class or the underprivileged, then you should use those people in the roles. It makes it more honest, and Ken Loach is on record as saying that he prefers working that way, and it's a very collaborative process. You know, he has a screenwriter, Paul Lafferty, who is married to a Spanish director, no, or a Spanish writer. And he lives in Madrid, actually, and all of their movies are there's no script as such. They have a very, you know, they have an outline, treatments of what needs to happen in every scene, but they leave it up to the actors to kind of to bring it about naturally, and that has a lot of honesty, I think, in the movie.
But the main actor is in fact a comedian.
Main comedian, yeah. He had a very good interview as well on Joe Rooney's Potteroony. It's probably the third time I've mentioned his podcast. But he started his own club night in Scotland like 20, 30, whatever years ago, and became this feature in Glasgow of the comedy scene. I think it was Glasgow. And he doesn't really have much acting experience. Went up for an audition with lots of different people, but eventually, you know, he got the part, obviously, and he did a good job. Upstaged by his female counterpart in the movie, it has to be said, she's, you know, the shining light on the acting standpoint.
She's had a lot of praise for
and
performance.
Very deserved praise. I mean, we'll talk about the criticisms, well, my personal criticisms of the movie, in a minute, and they're more on a technical level, or more of a film level, and they're minor, but we'll get to those. But like, going back to your question about the kind of imbalance in portraying them, now I've seen different things about this. You know, I mean, even in The Guardian has been quite good regards, covering the movie in lots of different ways, and mostly it's been positive. But I came across a review of it yesterday, a second review, because I've already reviewed it officially as a film, and it makes the point that workers and the working class in I, Daniel, aren't, you know, they're too unblemished, as if they're sanitized too much, and that weakens the argument. And it's he calls Ken Loach a conservative for treating it that way, which is absurd, because, you know, you can never use that word with Ken Loach, unless that sentence is, Ken Loach is not a conservative, because he's not. And, you know, I can see where he's coming from, but I think it's very wrong to say it that way, in my opinion, because you know, I think the movie works as a counterbalance to the negative stereotypes of the working class we already have in the media. If you look, because this movie's set in England, set in Britain, you have shows like Benefit Street and Benefit Street 2. I think that is a follow up to it as well, which kind of focused on these kind of characters who are kind of not maybe the nicest characters or the most warm characters, and people were complaining that it's exploitative, you know. And I'm sure there's people, you know, in every class of society who aren't likable or who aren't doing good things, and you can't airbrush those things. But even you have other shows like Shameless, which I know is a satire as well, but again, you have like this kind of feckless working class character who's kind of living by his wits and not contributing. So I think it's quite nice to see a working class character, who is really, you do have good people who are working class people. And also, he's making the point in the article that we don't show the undeserving poor, but you know, I don't think there is such a thing as undeserving poor, because if you're poor, you are deserving, and that's how the system should work. But also as well, I think what the movie shows, I know you didn't like this about the movie, but you know how, you know, almost uniformly bad the system was shown in the movie, and how maybe it's too black and white. But I think, you know, it was very well researched, I think, as a movie, and I think the trials and tribulations of Daniel Blake in the movie and of the other characters kind of corresponds quite well with real life testimonies. You know, like this bureaucracies of people who might fill out a form wrong, getting sanctioned or changing address, and the system couldn't handle that small detail being updated, so they had to wait for God knows how long to get their benefits. And I think the benefits system is probably set up in a way where it's very difficult to get the benefits, because the official view of successive Tory governments, let's be clear on this, I suppose, and the media as well, you know, probably see most of these people as skivers and scallywags and people who are trying to screw people over. And that's the negative perception that we have in lots of places, you know. And it comes to immigrants, it goes to the working class, like there's benefit frauds. We always hear about benefit frauds, but we don't hear about the most of the people who actually are genuinely deserving of help. And, you know, that they deserve to not feel dehumanized as well. And that's why I think, you know, even though it might be unbalanced in some respects, I can see where people are coming from, I think the message is very important, and I don't think it's that imbalanced in reality.
Okay. Well, this is like pretty deep stuff, but I'm just going to ask you a question that seems completely off topic, but I think it might be quite relevant. Why do you think of the fact that there was no music at all for the duration of the film? I mean, that's something that struck me quite a bit. It's very unusual to have an hour and a half,
yeah,
you know, without any sound whatsoever, yeah, apart from people's voices. Do you think, you know, do you think like the emphasis on people's voices was also like a way of empowering like these people's speeches?
I don't think it's that unusual. I don't think it's not common, but it's not so rare either. I know what you mean, but I think his productions are always usually pretty pared down. Now, I mentioned Trainspotting 2 at the start of the show, and that's very Danny Boyle's movies are very stylized and very have a very, you know, unique visual style, which you couldn't really say about The Wind That Shakes the Barley. You know, Wind Shakes the Barley, for example, or other movies by Ken Loach, they're very pared down and don't really feature a lot of music. In fact, The Wind Shakes the Barley, the only music that's really in the movie is when they're marching and they're singing a marching song. It's a very iconic song, O Roche de Baja Valle, which is about the Spanish leaving Ireland, actually, interestingly enough. So I can see where you're coming from. Maybe he wanted to emphasize artistically there's no music in their lives. They don't have much, you know, time to enjoy themselves, or they don't have much resources in the way of entertainment or disposable income to go and see and do something that makes them happy, you know. Or maybe it's a continuation of what his usual style is, you know. And I think so I don't know, I can't answer that question, but yeah, it's an interesting detail of his movie, though. Yes,
well, I think it's peculiar, yeah, because usually music is used as a device in films to kind of like prompt or like emphasize emotions.
Well, I think, you know, because he cares, he feels so deeply about the subject, that, you know, maybe
perhaps he feels that would distract from
not distract even, but just that it doesn't need any adornment, that he feels so obviously that this is wrong, and we're supposed to feel that it's wrong as well.
So the messages should be powerful enough.
Exactly. Exactly. And the fact that, you know, that quite a lot of bad things happen in the movie. And also, going back to the original question, that, you know, that they're too sanitized, I don't think that's true. You have the next door neighbors who sell counterfeit trainers, and you have one of the main characters who is forced into prostitution as well. Now, you know, they don't delve into it too much, but again, you have the limits in the medium. It's a 100-minute movie, but you know, you are seeing people who are kind of forced into kind of dark and less clean areas because of economic circumstances. But going back to the music situation as well, I think, you know, maybe the message doesn't need any adornments aside from what we see on screen, which almost acts as a testimony of real victims.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it would be fair to say that, in your opinion, the importance of the message kind of like justifies you know, what other people criticize as dramatism or like, you know, black and white.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think, you know, not every movie has to be political, you know, but this movie is, and that's not, I think that's a good thing. I mean, it exists as a medium to be political sometimes, and I think it is an important message. I really do think that. And I would recommend people to see it. Now, regarding my criticisms of the movie, I think we share the same ones. Sometimes the dialogue is a little on the nose. You know, it's a very obvious, you know, the character is introduced and says, okay, I'm X, and I'm poor because of this, X, Y, and Z. And, you know, the whole maxim of movie making is show, don't tell. And in some situations, they're telling, basically. But again, you know, his other work is different. You know, Kez, for example, is more artistic. When it Shakes the Barley as well, isn't so on the nose, you know. So I think maybe this is his last movie. Maybe, I don't know, he just ran out of, maybe he's tired to do it any other way. Or maybe, again, just the message supersedes everything, and the technical aspects of it are subservient to that main message. Or maybe it's just done in that way because, well, I mean, you know, artistically speaking, maybe it's not an interesting way to tell a story, but then again, you know, maybe people do say, or are very, maybe some people are open books, you know, so some people do just tell their life story just like that, you know. So, you know, even though it didn't, even though it diminished my enjoyment of the movie a little bit as a as a viewer, you know, I think as well that there could be an argument made for how that could be a realistic aspect as well. You know, things were seen transitions, maybe lacking music as well, you know, visually. Yeah, it's not going to win any plaudits for that. But then again, you know, I mean, Newcastle, when you have no money and you know, you're fighting the system, you know, I mean, it is what it is, you know. You don't need to adorn it with those other aspects as well. So.
Do you think it's a universal message, though? Do you think, you know, the location, well, it's just circumstantial, but do you think it's a criticism towards the state and administration as structures that, you know, could apply to virtually any Western European country?
I think it would, because the thing I forgot to mention, but I think it's very important, because I think the main message in that movie is that as a society, Britain used to help each other more, and that's probably true in other countries as well. And now they don't. And in the movie, we do see that. I know people say it's, well, everybody's helping each other, but maybe that aspect is exaggerated, but it's to tell it. It's to make a point, you know. And, like, you know, we did a podcast on refugees not so long ago, and, you know, about the Salvados program, and you know, and they're lamenting on the boat that the Spanish people weren't kind of interested in helping the immigrants, and maybe in the past, you know, I think, you know, you go back to the 40s, you know, or before the Second World War, people understood immigrants were escaping something terrible and wanted to give them asylum. Obviously, you had people who were against that. Daily Mail, for example, were kind of notorious for drumming the anti-Semitic drum in the 30s, you know, and how Jews shouldn't be let into Britain for political asylum. So you're always going to have these cranks.
And Spaniards too.
And Spaniards as well. Well, they're right about that, but I'm joking, of course. but no, like, you know, so you're always going to have those people who aren't open in that way, but probably as a civilization. And look at what, you know, United Nations, European Union, these are all, you know, for all their faults now, these are all institutions that were created out of a shared vision. And this vision had values, you know, that maybe we don't have anymore as a collective Western European society. So in that sense, I think it is a very universal message. And, you know, it's not a stretch of imagination to see that when the economy goes down, it's the poor and the voiceless who always get dumped on the first, you know. If there's cuts to be made, it's going to affect those the most. And I think the bureaucracy of benefit systems is something that's true in probably most countries.
Okay, well, that was a very complete, fascinating, you know, analysis of the movie. And well, I think the most valid point is the message, you know, the importance of, you know, regardless of whether we agree on the way that it was portrayed and the way that the message was, you know. Communicated the importance of the message, kind of supersedes.
Yeah,
that,
and at least Ken Loach is true to his voice and wants to say something, whether you agree with it or not. You know, I mean, it's not a cynical movie.
Yeah.
You know, where it's just a, you know, unnecessary sequel, or it's not really saying anything. You know.
Yeah, he's definitely not trying to please the public. He's just trying to say his opinion.
Yeah, and I think it got a standing ovation as well in Cannes. So you know, I mean.
I thought you were going to say got a standing ovation here in Madrid.
Well, one person tried to start it, but it didn't take. But yeah, so that's the movie. It's in the cinemas right now. So I would recommend going to see it. And if you like
it. Let us know your opinion, but if you don't agree with me, don't say.
You take the words right out of my mouth. So
that was funny, yes.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah, well. We should really take our off-air banter onto the air.
Oh, we should.
Well, okay, this is the part three of the show. Thank you for sticking with us this far and listening to my completely biased socialist drum beating. So if you are a conservative persuasion and you're still here, well, God, you have a lot of patience. So we're going to be back, of course, next week with another captivating episode of the El Arpa podcast. And in the meantime, stay safe, have fun, stock up on Christmas biscuits. 8 weeks away. We'll be doing the countdown every week until you're sick of hearing the word Christmas. Anything else you want to say? Who are we talking to? Setting up an interview for next week?
Yes, well, a very important character in the 20th century.
Yeah, it's a figure we've done a podcast on before, and befitting of a podcast today of movies, we were talking to a Charlie Chaplin impersonator. Yes. you're playing
Chaplin himself.
You're playing a silent era Chaplin by not talking.
Well,
there.
I was actually like, you know, doing some gestures, but you didn't get it.
I was waiting for the black screen with the writing to explain what was happening. So yeah, he's an Irishman who grew up in London, has lived in Turkey and travelled around a bit. He's officially retired, lives here with his wife, and he's a Charlie Chaplin impersonator. You can take a picture with him. And we're going to be filming his story and, just seeing what he's about and what it's like pretending to be somebody else.
In another country,
exactly. So, El Arpa podcast, end of saying bye-bye. And
Maria, saying bye.
Thank you very much. You're listening to Subsound Radio. We bring you streaming and live broadcasting from the capital. This is the El Arpa podcast.